This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with the final edition of our series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications. Nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
That's Comedy Tonight from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, the first Broadway musical with music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. He's America's greatest living music theater composer and among the best who ever lived. A new DVD box set collects performances of six Sondheim shows, including Sweeney Todd, Passion, and Follies. There's also a new book about the creation of Follies. We begin with some comments Sondheim made at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York during their 1993 retrospective of his work for television. When Sondheim was a teenager, his mentor was the lyricist Oscar Hammerstein, who was also a neighbor and friend of the family. Sondheim said he was encouraged by Hammerstein to avoid imitation and to find his own voice.
When I was first writing love songs, at the age of 18, I would write about larks learning to pray. And he would say to me, but you know, you don't believe this stuff. I said, no, but it, I mean, what? He said, what do you feel about it? I said, well, I don't know. He said, have you ever been in love? I said, no. He said, well, then you have to try to get inside the character that you're writing for. But don't write what I write, write what you write. Then he said something really smart. He said, and if you do that, he said, you'll be 90% ahead of everybody else. And as soon as he put it on a competitive level, a little click went off my head, you know? But what he meant was that most people do not write for character. They write, or even out of their own hearts, at least in the musical theater in those days. He was one of the few who did. They wrote according to a sort of standard set of feelings. You know, it used to be called pop song feelings, or it used to be called June moon feelings. Oscar was one of the few people who understood writing for character, and that's what he was telling me to do. And that lesson probably was the single most valuable one I ever learned.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in 1993 at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. Sondheim got his start writing lyrics for Leonard Bernstein's music for the show West Side Story. Before we hear a 1988 interview I recorded with Sondheim, let's listen to the Jet song from West Side Story.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you...
In 1988, Stephen Sondheim told me that he didn't like the idea of starting his Broadway career as a lyricist.
No, I was trained as a composer, and that's what I wanted to do. I'd majored in music, and I'd studied music on a scholarship with Milton Babb for 2 years. And it was an accident, and I wouldn't have done it except that Oscar thought it was a good idea for me to do it, because Bernstein and Jerry Robbins and Arthur Lawrence were seasoned professionals, and I was, you know, 25 years old, and he thought it would be a good learning experience for me. And he was right.
Those are the first lyrics you wrote that got performed on Broadway. They've become classics. When you listen back to them, how do you feel about them?
I didn't like them then, and I don't like them now. And there are two lyrics I like. The rest of them sound very written to me.
Which ones are the ones that you like?
Something's Coming and the Jet Song. The others are, you know, they're very self-conscious, but that was partly Lenny's influence, because he very much wanted the show to be important, and that to him important meant that the lyrics should be, quote, poetic, and his idea of poetic and mine are different, and I think what he really wanted was purple prose, and I wanted simplicity, which is what I'd gotten from Oscar. So I think the lyrics are very self-conscious. I was bending over to please everybody, of course, because I was so young, and So I find, you know, except for the occasional line, I think they're pretty embarrassing.
You worked with Julie Stein on Gypsy. You wrote the lyrics for
that. That was the next show, yes.
Now, in his autobiography, he said one of the things he liked about working with you is that you never asked for extra notes. does that mean, like, if you find a three-syllable word that you think is just perfect, that you beg the composer for two extra notes?
No, well, no, this, no, actually, no. I think. first of all, most of the lyrics in Gypsy, the music sort of followed the lyrics. That say, I would write sample quatrains or couplets and give them rhythms to work from. No, in fact, I'd never do that anyway. When I work with a composer, I've only worked with three, but once in West Side Story, I asked for extra syllables. I mean, a number of the tunes in West Side Story were taken out of Candide that were not used in Candide. One of them was a song called One, which was composed of dotted half notes, and it went one hand, one heart. But I said, when we got to Washington, I said, it's just too few notes there, and the words just too heavy and too pretentious, and at least, you know, if you give me three-quarter notes instead of one dotted half, I would appreciate it. Well, the lyric's still pretty pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as it was. Maybe Julie had that from other people. I don't believe in, though, like everybody else, I often tend to be verbose. When I write lyrics, I try to fight against it. And I remember Oscar used to set me exercises in theory and say, you know, write a whole note melody and a whole note lyric, a whole note meaning, you know, where you have to sustain a note, like you wrote a song called Who with Jerome Kern. When you, who stole my heart away? Well, if you hear that tune, it's hard to set that lyric because you've got to find a word where the singer can sustain the vowel sound and where it's natural punctuation, and it's hard to do. And I think most lyric writers tend to be verbose, and I think that's what Julie was probably referring to, was that, you know, I'd been trained quite the reverse way. Not that there aren't wordy lyrics in Gypsy, but there aren't very many of them.
When you started writing your own music, did you feel like you were carrying on the tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein in any way, or did you feel like you were breaking from that?
Oh, no, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein, certainly, absolutely.
What about what they had done felt like what you were doing? What is the tradition exactly?
Oh, it's a tradition. It's something Oscar really started with Showboat. It's he combined the whole European operetta idea with the American musical comedy idea. And the American musical comedy idea was, you know, a series of songs with jokes in between. And the operetta idea was a series of, you know, Graustarkian situations with outlandish romantic variations on them. And essentially an excuse for singers to let forth with large romantic or choral pieces. And with Showboat, he attempted to bring some realism into the musical theater and to combine the two so that they became what you could call a musical play. Not an opera, but a musical play. And somewhere between an operetta and a musical comedy. And that was not taken up very much by other people during the 30s, and Oscar tried a few himself, and they failed. So it wasn't until Oklahoma came along and was such a gigantic success that the movement was resuscitated. And after that, virtually everybody started to write what they call integrated musicals, in which the songs carry the story forward instead of just being respites and moments between jokes and block comedy scenes. And that's essentially what I was doing.
I want to play one piece that you've written, and this is from your opera, Sweeney Todd. And I thought it might be interesting to...
It's nice to call it an opera, but please, let's call it a musical.
Call it a musical. Yeah, why would you prefer that to opera?
Well, because it doesn't belong in an opera house. Though it's mostly sung, there's a good deal of dialogue in it, and I'd say about 20% is dialogue. And it's not for operatic voices. It's not about the singer. Operas are about the singer, not about the opera.
Why don't you like to write for operatic voices, by the way?
Because they push it. They're interested in the voice and not in the material. And I'm interested in the material. And that's just the way they're trained, and that's what audiences come to hear. Audiences do not come to hear the piece, they come to hear the singers.
Well, from Sweeney Todd, what I've chosen to play is a part called The Epiphany, and this is a part where the whole character of the main character changes. Throughout the show, he's been interested in revenge against one person, and it's a kind of just revenge that he's seeking. But when his revenge is thwarted, He becomes pathological and is interested in killing anybody who enters his barbershop. He'll take any head that walks in. This is a turning point. Before we hear it, just tell me a little bit about the challenge that writing this presented to you.
Well, the piece is based on a play by an English playwright named Christopher Bond, an excellent version of this story, which has been told for 130 years, 150 now. And it's always been a kind of 19th century melodrama with blood and guts and thunder sheets. And Christopher Bond, a British playwright, got hold of it in the 70s. He was with an acting troupe, and they were going to put it on for their Christmas show. And they read it. The scripts arrived a little late, and they read it, and they only had 3 weeks to go, and they realized how terrible even the last version was, which would have been, I think, 1956 was the last version that was written. So he said, don't worry about it, I'll rewrite it. And he rewrote it, and he changed, kept the essential plot, which is about a murderer, mass murderer, and who kills people in his barber chair, and who's colleague, Mrs. Lovett, turns them into meat pies and becomes the most successful entrepreneur of meat pies in London as a result. And he motivated it by giving Sweeney Todd this whole revenge motive, which was never, ever part of the story. And the only difficulty he had in motivating the whole play was turning the personal revenge into mass revenge, which, of course, didn't matter in the originals, because in the originals he was just this kind of crazed, greedy murderer who killed people for their money. And that was not the case with Bond's version. And I had to figure out some reason to justify the moment. Bond justified the moment with a single sentence, which even he admitted was sort of a weak stab, which Sweeney said, in effect, I've tasted blood and now my thirst is great. And I'd never bought that, and neither, I think, did Chris Bond. So I try to think of a reason that he would turn from being a single-minded murderer into this kind of crazed mass murderer. And I came up with this notion in the Epiphany, which has to do with the social situation and really has to do with the lower classes and the upper classes, which is something that Bond, who was and is a sort of left-wing playwright, had touched on but hadn't used for this particular moment. And what Sweeney does, in effect, is blame the world for his difficulties, for his problems, for the rape and suicide of his wife. And, in fact, he's right. And so to blame the social structure for his personal tragedy gave me the key so that he could then say, and now I will kill everybody in the social structure, high and low. And that's what it amounts to.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. Though we all deserve to die, tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die, and I'll never see Joanna. Sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, greeters. You, sir, anybody, gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor 10 men, nor 100 can assuage me. I will have you. Ha!
And I will get him back even as he gloats. In the meantime, I'll practice on less honorable throats. And my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive at last, and I'm full of joy.
Len Carreyrou from the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd. We'll hear more of Sondheim's 1988 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're concluding our holiday series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway, with the music of Stephen Sondheim. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with Sondheim.
You know, it seems to me that in all your songs, you always bring in very specific elements of the drama that's going on.
Yes, well, I'm into that. I'm into sort of naturalistic songwriting. And like in The Worst Pies in London, in that show, you know, I worked out where she's dusting, blowing dust off her pies and slapping roaches and things like that. It's all worked into the music. Each slap and each blow, and I like working that kind of thing in. It first of all, it helps the director to give him a very specific blueprint of what the action should be, so that if he wants to change it, he can, but he has something to work from, and he doesn't have to turn to you and say, well, how do I fill this moment? And I like to, I think it's fun to write songs, you know, for people who have colds or who stutter or, you know, who cough or who can't remember what they're saying, the kinds of things we do in real life.
Is that why you like to work in the setting of Broadway shows, because there are details of a story to work into a song? It's not just a generic love song. There's characters.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's exactly why, yes. I'd much rather write for character and situation. I wouldn't know how to just write a song, because I would have to invent a character in a situation if you asked me to write a song. The few songs I've written, like, for, I know, people's birthdays and things like that, that I've written, apart from dramatic situations, I've had to invent the dramatic situation or take it out of a real-life situation.
Have you ever taken a lyric of yours and changed it because you thought it was too clever?
I've taken it, yes, I have, when I think the audience isn't getting it, or when I think it's out of character. I did it in Into the Woods. There was a nice couplet in a song called No More, and it was very graceful, and it was too graceful for the character. Yes, I will take it out sometimes, not often, because I usually do that in my study while I'm writing it, when I think that it's either out of character or when I think that it may be something difficult for the audience to assimilate quickly, because the whole point of a song is, as opposed to a poem, which you can read at your own speed, the lyric goes by at its speed and you have to catch up with it. So it's up to the lyric writer and the composer to make it clear to the audience, at the same time not lag behind them nor be so far ahead of them that they get baffled. So sometimes you have to underwrite lyrics for just that purpose. You have to give them air, and you have to make the lyrics simpler than you would if it was on paper.
I know that you collect puzzles and you're interested in puzzles. Is lyric writing similar to a puzzle?
Oh, sure.
And the problems you have to solve?
All art is. All you have to solve, and the same thing as with a painting or with a novel. I mean, you're always solving problems of structure, architecture, and things like that. In lyrics, I think it's more critical because there are so many fewer words. I don't know what kind of I just violated some basic speech. So many fewer words. But anyway, there are fewer words, and therefore each one becomes important. Also, since I believe in writing lyrics that reflect the inflection of regular speech, the rise and fall of the language, and how long you sustain a word in a given line becomes, to my ear anyway, critical if you're trying to give the impression of naturalistic speech. One of the problems with Sweeney Todd was I didn't want the audience to laugh at this melodrama. I mean, we do live in the 20th century, and people don't go for this kind of blood and thunder stuff anymore, and it's much more horrible out on the street than it is on the stage. But I also didn't want them to think that they were, quote, at an opera. So one of the triumphs for me of Sweeney Todd is I look around the second act at the audience's face. They don't know that people are singing. They really think they're talking, because they're so involved with the story and what's going to happen next and who's going to get killed next, they don't realize they're being sung at. And that's a result of lyric writing being so seeming like dialogue. And that kind of stuff comes through a lot of sweat, and that's what working out a puzzle is.
Stephen Sondheim, recorded in 1988. We'll hear an excerpt of a more recent interview with him in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.